Welcome to the Mac Express, where we dive deep into the sport, business, and culture of show jumping. I'm your host, Michael Cruciati, and whether you're a writer, a fan, or someone just curious about horsepower behind the global sport, this podcast is for you. Each week, we will bring you exclusive interviews, must-watch Grand Prix previews, and weekend recaps that break down the biggest stories in the ring. From behind-the-scenes insights to industry-shaping conversations, we're here to connect the dots between passion, performance, and the people who power this sport. For our very first episode, I am sitting down with Dr. Michelle Hollis, the advisory doctor to the Kevin Bavington Foundation. We'll explore the realities of rider safety, the medical complexities of spinal injuries, and what the equestrian community needs to know about protecting its athletes. So saddle up, this is the Mac Express, and we're just getting started. My guest is Dr. Michelle Hollis, an emergency medical physician, equestrian, and one of the medical professionals at the forefront of spinal cord injury research and rider safety. From hospital trauma units to the warm-up ring, Dr. Hollis brings a unique dual perspective on how we prevent, treat, and recover from some of the most devastating injuries in our sport. Dr. Hollis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
So as we get into, we have some really cool discussion topics today ranging from a whole multitude of things. But first, let's start off with what led you to get into medicine and a little bit about your background that both helped shape you as a professional in the medical field as well as a writer.
Okay. Well, so writing came first. I came to the hunter jumper world when I was 17, so I was a little late to the party. I went to Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and was a working student in Germantown for a trainer named Holly Hugo Vidal. I didn't really know what I wanted to do other than take care of horses, and I really enjoyed that and the opportunities to ride. And she had some suggestions about what I should do with my life and thought that medicine would be a good fit. Along the way, riding, taking care of horses, medicine, there's some parallels there. Taking care of horses is a lot like taking care of people. Horse people are just like horses.
Yeah, they don't tell you what's actually happening. You kind of have to guess sometimes.
Yeah, well, you do. And you have to guess sometimes when they really need help. Some are easier to take care of than others. You have to earn their trust. You have to focus on their needs and best interests. You can't lie to them. You can't take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. Horse people are like horses. They're herd animals.
Yep, and sometimes you just want to bubble wrap them and say, stay put. Do not move.
And that's very hard to do because they generally have their own ideas about where they want to go. They will jump the fence if you push too far. So,
yeah. So you were introduced to the medical fields when? So you're growing up riding, and you were said, how did you get into actually what you do in your practice?
Once I had decided that I wanted to go to medical school, I went through all the rotations, and emergency medicine appealed to me because it was a defined schedule, and I liked the variety of things, and it was a good fit for me professionally. So I think the moment that I went to a horse show after I had finished residency, I started to see things differently. You start to really see opportunities for doing things differently in the field of safety and response and so forth. And I became interested in head injuries, actually, because it was a hot topic at the time. I think at the time, NFL was working pretty closely with the University of Pittsburgh to come to some protocols. And I think we had started to talk about that in the horse world. So that was when I first started thinking about combining horse sport with medical practice.
Interesting. Yeah, I have quite a bit of knowledge in the on the football side of things, not the horse side. Obviously, I'm not a rider, but the football side, my career was just ending right as they really started taking CTE seriously. When I was playing, and especially in high school and early parts of college, it was, oh, you just got your bell rung, you're all right, get back in there. Now it's taken a lot more serious.
You're a big guy. I bet you played. Did you play on the line?
Yep, I was an offensive lineman, so my position was left guard, so I was guaranteed to hit someone every play.
Yeah, you were going to get a head injury. That was going to happen for sure.
Yeah, the joke that I tell my wife is that there's some practice in games I don't really remember.
Well, there's some riders who could say the same. There's probably some that some don't remember. So that happens.
And so the technology, I mean, we're going to get into a little bit of the safety products that are out on the market now, but like, this is just very, very recent, the Virginia Tech study of round number two with the helmets. Did you take a look at that at all?
Yeah, they're trying to look at research that allows them to better predict what happens when a rider falls.
Okay.
With the rotational type injuries and the way the head strikes the ground. It's not just the head strike that tends to cause concussion. It can be the actual rotation itself and the movement of the head inside the movement of the brain inside the skull.
Mm.
So I think that they're trying to look at things. They're trying to take a little deeper dive into how helmets are protective or not. It's very hard to prevent. You can't prevent all concussion.
Mm-hmm.
You can prevent a lot of structural injury, which is when you have damage to the skull or to the actual brain, where you're bleeding in the skull, that you can protect from a lot with helmets, but you can't really protect 100% from concussion because some of that's, it's not an external force, it's an internal force.
Right. And it's just sometimes how someone hits the ground and almost there's a whip motion when their head hits the ground, and it's hard to prevent the brain from rattling around inside the head.
Right.
Yeah. It's a, horse show jumping and equestrian in general is quite a unique set of challenges just because of the style in which people can potentially fall off. And that's really where I wanted to dive into a lot of it with you today is, you know, it does create a unique type of challenge when comparing it to other athletic injuries. And so how have you seen the big differences between a normal injuries that may be sustained in a sport like football or even tennis to an equestrian injuries?
Well, the spinal cord injury in any sport is going to be very different than other athletic injuries. When you have a broken bone, when you have a pulled hamstring, those are all injuries that have a typical projected path with a range of accepted timeframes for full recovery and healing. When you have injury to neurons, there's very little capacity for self-repair when we talk about neuronal injury. Whether that's the brain or the spinal cord, each injury is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that when you have an injury that is severe, that you have the ability to go straight to a level one trauma center. And it is important that you have the capacity to go to a good rehabilitation center after the initial visit with the trauma center and stabilization. It's important to have a period of recovery in a place that is that specializes in rehabilitative care.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, because what I'm learning as well as I really dive into now that I've been with the foundation for about 2 years is there is quite a big difference from what Kevin sustained to what actually, what I've come to find out is quite common in the industry is having compression fractures in vertebrae, and then the difference between that and what actually happened to Kevin. Can you describe that? Because I'm learning as I go here. But what is the big differences between those?
Between a compression fracture and
a spinal cord injury, yeah.
Okay, so the spinal cord is encased in a canal that's formed by the bones in the back, so to speak. The cervical spine provides a space for the spinal cord. When you have an injury to the spine itself, sometimes you can have a broken bone, sometimes not.
Mm-hmm.
It's the cord that's inside of that canal that carries the synapses that communicate between the brain and the rest of the body.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, you can have a fracture without injuring the cord, or you can have the injury to the cord without having a fracture of the bones.
Interesting.
I believe in his case that he had both. Mm-hmm. A bony injury and also had a cord injury.
Got it. And when did you come on and partner with the foundation and work with Jeff and everybody else? When did that come along in the timeline? I know I'm kind of jumping around here, but that's kind of a really interesting to hear, like, when you actually came on and started consulting with Jeff and everybody.
So I was asked to help Kevin for the same reason that I get involved in the care of a lot of equestrians. He didn't have a primary care physician at the time, and there were a lot of questions about what he needed. So my background is in emergency medicine, and we're sort of the problem solvers of medicine. You come to the emergency department with whatever your issue is, and we try to decide if you have an emergency or not and what you need next. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of episodic care, and I happen to specialize in figuring out what people need and where they need to go and finding resources. Mm-hmm. So respectfully for Kevin, he is the captain of his team. He has a number of caregivers who are involved, and I provide support when he needs it. So we've been working together for several years now. I guess it was right around the time of COVID.
Okay.
that we started working together. And through our time together, we've spent some time sitting around, we've had time to talk. And so we've had a lot of time to talk about safety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because that's my particular interest. We've talked a little bit about how we implement emergency action plans. What happens when someone has a fall? How quick is the response? What type of personnel are there that are available to help? What's the closest hospital? What's the closest level one trauma center? Those are all things that you need to have in place before a show gets started. And so we've had a lot of conversations around that.
Amazing. And so my mind's going a million miles a second right now to think of, like, okay, what does that actually look like? Because I mean, I live here in Wellington, so I probably 3-4 times a season I see the trauma hawk coming over. And so is that part of that response? Talk to me about that setup, what the horse shows have to have and how it's improved over the last several years.
Well, WEF does a really good job, actually. WEF has a lot of resources. And I don't believe that there's a show manager out there who cares more about what happens when someone has a fall than Dave Burton. Dave is very much on the ball. Whenever someone falls off, you'll see him headed for the ring to, you know, sort of watch out and make sure that things are going according to plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I think having a show manager like that who really cares about the outcome is critically important. So basically, you start with pre-planning, right? Mm-hmm. Developing relationships with the local hospitals, developing relationships with the local EMS companies, make sure that in the event that something happens, you have a seamless handoff from the time the incident occurs to the time you get the person to transport and then the transport to the hospital. All of that needs to happen fast. So mm-hmm. In South Florida, it's pretty common to have trauma protocols that activate the trauma hawk for you to travel to the trauma center, because maybe at least 30 minutes away by ground, maybe more, depending on traffic. So there's a pretty liberal use of the trauma hawk there in South Florida.
Okay. Okay. And so obviously, because WEF has the resources to do that, so then also implementing that in maybe a more local show provides us several different types of hurdles. Have you worked with any of the smaller horse shows to implement this strategy?
Yeah. So as a matter of fact, after some of my conversations with Kevin, I started thinking about, you know, how could I help some of the smaller horse shows, some of the, you know, legacy horse shows that maybe only a week or two instead of months at a time. I asked Joe Farges at Upperville if I could come and observe what they were doing in their program and work on their protocols. And he was kind enough to let me. Mm-hmm. So I spent some time there and we worked on how we respond, how quickly we respond when someone falls, what we do when someone falls, and how quickly we can get them from the ring to the point where they can be received by a transport EMS to take them wherever they need to go. If they're going to go by ground, then they leave mm-hmm. in the ambulance to go to the closest facility. If they need to go to the trauma center, then we have a protocol with a local EMS crew where they receive them at the gate and take them to the ball field where they get in a helicopter and go to Fairfax. Mm-hmm. And that's it's taken some time and it's taken developing relationships, but all preparation is about developing relationships and the preparedness arena.
Right. Right. And so what is the ideal timeline and how quickly, obviously the sooner the better, but what does that timeline look like from there is an incident to when you can get them to the trauma center? What is the ideal time to get them to that spot to mitigate the amount of potential harm that injury has sustained?
In trauma, there's a tradition that revolves around something called the golden hour. You would like for someone to be able to be in the trauma center, in the hands of the trauma of doctors, within an hour from the time that something happens. Mm-hmm. So often is going to be a situation where you need helicopter transport if you're somewhere that's fairly rural in order to get to an actual trauma center mm-hmm. in that time.
Okay. So the golden hour. And so what are horse shows currently working to implement this strategy with you other than Upperville? And so what has that response been both at the horse show level and then has even USCF reached out to start to implement these types of plans?
Well, I think USCF is a much broader umbrella, right? They have so many different affiliates. We have Hunter Jumper, and we like to think of ourselves as the most important because we're big. But USCF has eventing, they have dressage, they have Western, they have all the breeds and disciplines, and that sort of covers a lot of area. Mm-hmm. Different facilities are going to have different needs. The different types of equestrian competition are going to have different needs mm-hmm. in terms of how much risk they have. So yes, I would love to help everywhere that I can help. But most of my focus so far has been on Hunter Jumper shows.
Okay.
And I've had the opportunity to help at Washington International and Capital Challenge and Upperville, hoping to do some more work with other horse shows as we move along.
Absolutely. Yeah, because it's from what you describe, it's not an easy process of like, okay, you have nothing, and then the next day you have this entire system all set up. It takes time to create those relationships and partnerships and understanding the best way, if something were tragic to happen like that, to be able to get them to where they need to be. It's not a flipping on a light switch.
No, it's not. It takes some background work, and it takes digging into the community and seeing where you can find personnel that are appropriate to work at the show. Well, you need EMTs, you need paramedics, and sometimes finding the appropriate staff can be a little bit difficult as well, because the local area. So there's a bit of research involved and getting things set up, and then there's actually executing the plan. You can walk a course and have an absolutely perfect direct seven planned, but you jump in the line and you end up having to do the bending eight. it can be like that.
Right.
You have to be flexible and be able to adjust and adapt and still manage to get the job done. So
one of my favorite quotes of all time is everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And then that plan goes out the window.
Right. plan until you jump in too long, and then what are you going to do? Are you going to pull? Are you going to bend? Are you going to run? What are you going to? How are you going to get down the line? So it's very, very much like that. So the idea was born from Upperville that we would have a foundation that can handle helping the facilities and the show managers create what they need in terms of an emergency action protocol.
That's awesome. Yeah. And
so that's where we are right now.
That's where you're at right now. That sounds like a fantastic foundation to be able to implement those strategies and those action plans.
That's the idea. The main project right now, and the main focus is partnering with horse shows and horse show managers to make sure that each place has facility specific guidelines and protocols that provide the most prompt response, the most efficient response, the most correct response according to pre-hospital guidelines, and then seamlessly interface with the local facilities so that patients who need to go to a trauma center can go quickly to a trauma center, and patients who can go to the regular hospital can go there.
Great. Yeah, and we've been talking a lot about after the injury happens, and so kind of switching gears to before the injury happens and prevention. And so air vests, I mean, that's the hot button issue that people are talking about, and will it ever be mandated? What's the actual credibility of it? What have you seen in the last year or so with the air vests and the data that has been being procured with that? Are they helpful?
So air vests are a little bit of a sticky subject. We talked about these at annual meeting for USHJA. And regarding air vests, I have to preface this with my opinion is my own. It does not represent the interests of USHJA, USEF, or the Equestrian Health and Safety Foundation. That being said, safety vests are useful for torso protection. The torso being the chest, back area.
Mm-hmm.
Evidence has shown that hard shell body protectors are safe and they're effective for the prevention of torso injuries. In fact, the U.S. Eventing Association requires the use of body protectors for cross-country competition. They allow air vests as an option over the body protector, but the air vest is not to be worn alone.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I believe that if a rider wants to feel safer, then they should consider wearing the type of vest that's worn by eventers. There's no research yet that shows that an air vest can protect the cervical spine.
Hmm. Okay.
And in fact, there is some anecdotal and theoretical evidence to suggest that it may increase the risk of cervical injury, because with the body protector, you're still allowed some flexibility of the thoracic spine. You can still bend mm-hmm. a little bit. When you take away that flexibility and make the thoracic spine rigid, the neck is still left flexible. So in the event that you have an axial loading injury where the head is directly pointed at the ground, you risk that weak part being the cervical spine, and you have an increased energy load at that point.
Okay. So let me describe that in so that I understand it as well. So you're reinforcing the torso so that it's rigid and protecting that area. However, if you have an injury, say someone lands on their head, that space between the base of the head to the base of their neck is unprotected. And so because you've strengthened everything else up, that's the part that takes the brunt of the load. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay. And so that until we can solve that issue of that space between there will always be some risk when having any sort of vest that can't prevent that.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I'm almost envisioning like what will have to be is almost like an airbag system that deploys around the individual's neck when they fall off. Now, that probably won't be very popular, but I can't think of any other way to secure that area of your neck.
Well, and that's only going to be helpful if you can take it all the way up past the head.
Right, like a bubble around your head.
Like a bubble around the entire person.
Interesting. Yeah, it's going to be really weird and interesting to see what the governing bodies do in the next several years, because show jumping is fairly slow to adopt those mandates. I mean, they took a very long time to mandate helmets, and then now I know they're collecting a lot of data with the air vest, but show jumping has not mandated air vests yet, or any vest of that matter.
Well, and when we think about sport, all sport involves some risk. We should mitigate risk as much as possible. There is going to be injury in sport. It's important to try to do the things that we can do on the front end to try to reduce risk. Why do people fall in the first place? Is it because people are sometimes taking too much risk? Mm-hmm. We should also be looking at how we design courses, how we enforce the rules around how quickly we go, mm-hmm. using the optimal time classes for the lower levels. There are a lot of things that we can do to help mitigate risk,
right,
on the front end to try to prevent the falls in the first place.
Right.
I'm falling a lot, maybe going back and taking some lessons and figuring out why you're falling so much.
Yep, we always got to go back to lessons, for sure.
I always go back to basics.
Yeah, I remember when I was playing football, it's the same thing. I mean, you're never going to eliminate every potential aspect that could get you injured. I mean, whether you're doing race cars, you're playing football, basketball, there's always going to be some inherent risk with what you do. And that's part of what makes it exciting, is that element of danger to it. But looking at it in all aspects of sport to mitigate that potential risk for a catastrophic event, I think that's where people are really starting to open their eyes and be like, at least in my view, is should I actually be competing in this level, or should I wait and stay at the lower level until I'm more comfortable going up to a bigger level?
Yes, I do think that's important. I think it's hard for trainers to say, we need to stay at this lower level for a little bit longer. But I think that requires some courage on their part.
Yeah.
And it's important. It's a part of our responsibility.
Yeah. So the next part that I wanted to talk about, because this actually is fairly recent, CBS News did a spotlight on quite an interesting tech company out of Europe, and they were attaching probes in on people's heads who were had suffered catastrophic injuries with their spinal cord, and they were starting to see great advancements in helping them walk. I wanted to get your thoughts on that news segment. One, does it have credibility? And two, are we getting closer to being able to reconnect those nerves from a severed spine?
Yes. Yeah, so this actually came to my attention a couple of years ago in a newsletter from the NIH. Dr. Jocelyn Block is a Swiss neurosurgeon and scientist who's leading the NeuroRestore Laboratory in Lausanne, Switzerland. She started with some work in decoding the brain map for the purposes of deep brain stimulation in patients with movement disorders like Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's led to consideration of spinal cord stimulation to help people with spinal cord injury be able to move their arms and legs. So this work actually is fairly legitimate, and it's been going on for a long time and does seem to have a lot of promise. Actually,
that's really cool. And because the brain does not talk in zeros and ones like a computer does. So decoding how the brain talks to the limbs and the rest of the body is not easy.
Right. And it's the areas of the deep brain that can be stimulated so that you can help aid in the movement disorders. And really, this is absolutely outside my area of expertise. But I know that these scientists are working very hard to find ways to help the body work around the injured neuronal connections so that the synaptic highway, if you will, becomes functional again.
What a world we're living in. And what type of timeline do you think that is? I know that's not your area of expertise to look at the next 5-6 years, but is this something that we could see in the next decade of being introduced?
I think it would be great to see it in the next decade. I know that Dr. Block is hopeful. She did a TED Talk in 2016 where she talked about her research. It's actually a really nice TED Talk. She talks about it in a way that's meaningful for laypersons to understand. And since that time, she's continued to work very hard. And at that time, I think she was feeling like it was just around the corner, just around the corner. So you do the work, you measure your results, you keep going. It's hard to say. But I do think that what they're doing is A, legitimate, and B, hopeful. One of the ways that you can tell if research is legitimate or whether a resource center is something that you would want to support is to first look at the academic environment where the research is taking place, and then to look at whether they're publishing papers in legitimate peer-reviewed publications.
Okay.
And she has over 180 research works with over 10,000 citations, and citations are points where other researchers have cited your work in their publication. So you know that what she's doing has legitimacy and purpose, and is being studied by a lot of other people. So I do think that that's a pretty exciting venture there at NeuroRestore in Switzerland.
That's awesome. And for people listening in, if you want to look up that video, you can Google CBS News, injuries left them paralyzed, an early promising clinical trial is helping them walk short distances again. And I definitely recommend you guys taking a look at that. That video is quite amazing. Dr. Hollis, thank you for joining us on the Mac Express. Your work, your voice, and your perspective is so invaluable, and not just for the riders who are already affected by this, but for the ones who may never have to be. And thank you for the work that you and others are doing in this. And so I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate having the opportunity to chat.
Great. And so for anyone else interested in supporting the Kevin Babington Foundation or learning more about spinal injury prevention and equestrian sport, you can visit kevinbabingtonfoundation.org. And this is the Mac Express. I'm Michael Cruciati. Ride smart, ride safe, and we'll see you next time.